Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about what a single use of an antibiotic can do to your body and your health from the Academy of Center of Dentistry in the Netherlands, how mindfulness meditation is better than anything else when it comes to reducing pain, Wake Forest Medical Center, when it was put up against some of the other therapies out there. Also, we're going to look at men who eat soy have lower lung cancer risk and how fish oil supplementation when pregnant could help you alleviate lung injury, modulate your immunity, and reduce inflammation from a China university, and how escalating coenzyme Q10 doses, meaning you increase it, is associated with declining oxidative stress from University of Washington, what that means. It's important. And a lot more on health and healing. Today, I'm going to do a lot of mini commentaries. I'm going to look at Joe Quinn, when he took a look back as a journalist, what he wrote 10 years ago about Iraq, and today Iraq lies in ruins, as new evidence confirms U.S. government used death squads to manufacture a civil war. This is a whole rewriting of the historical playbook on Iraq, new information. Also today, how the government crackdown on whistleblowers betrays our public trust. Just an overview. What does it mean when we say that we're going to protect people who come forward who have qualified information on corruption and crimes by members of our government, and then when they do that, we hit them with the Espionage Act and put them in prison? Well, one of the people who was a victim, Susan Lindauer, a CIA operative, major former CIA asset, is going to talk about what it means when the government goes after you for telling the truth. We're also going to look at how America's opiate epidemic was started by one pharmaceutical company, Mike Marini from Pacific Standard, on that. And then the astounding number of medical procedures that have no benefit whatsoever. In fact, they do harm. Who says? The Journal of the American Medical Association says. Then for the last part of our program today, our scholar in resident, Richard Gale, will be taking points from Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, from the Democratic perspective, Jill Stein from the Greens, and the only progressive, and then all the different Republicans, and playing devil's advocate. So let's see what a real progressive counterpoint would be. I think you'll find it interesting. I can promise you, you will learn things that you did not know about the candidates that you were supporting. Let's begin. Antibiotics are necessary in some conditions. They can actually save lives and have. That is not in dispute. But in 1972, I wrote about their overuse. And then again in 73, 74, in a book called Body Pollution, I talked about how antibiotics used in animal food and in regular medical practice was creating thresholds in the body that then when you needed an antibiotic, the body had developed a resistance and the antibiotics that we normally use wouldn't work. It's called antibiotic resistance. So then people began to die. Back in 1974, I wrote this, 31 years ago. Well, it's only gotten worse. This is from the Academy Center of Dentistry in the Netherlands, published through the American Society of Microbiology in their peer-reviewed journal, InBio. Quote, I'm quoting directly from the study, a single course of antibiotics has enough strength to disrupt the normal makeup of microorganisms in the gut for as long as a year, potentially leading to antibiotic resistance, European researchers reported this week. So here's what we have to understand. We need to keep a healthy gut. We need also to be aware that the stronger our immune system is, the less likely will be the negative effects of any environment we're in. For example, when I go onto an airplane, which is rather frequent, I'm going into a petri dish, which is where you grow out bacteria, viruses, and people are coughing. No one knows how many different strains of bacteria and viruses are in the air, but a lot. And that's without people being in flu or cold season where there's a lot of coughing and sneezing and not everyone wears a mask, not everyone coughs into a contained environment like a hanky. And hence, you're going to be exposed. Fine. If your immune system is strong, if your gut bacteria are healthy, then you'll be able to take in that bad microorganism, your body will identify it, and destroy it. So you get off the plane, you're not going to get sick. But someone else has been exposed, who hasn't eaten well, who already has multiple inflammations in their body, in their knees, in their muscles, fibromyalgia, rheumatoid arthritis, who may be having inflammation in the brain, with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. These people can get a lot sicker. So the whole idea is the stronger you make your immune system every day through what you think and what you eat and how the air you breathe, the environment you're in, the people you associate with, the better able you are to withstand the normal types of exposures that we're all up for. I'm not suggesting anyone should live in isolation. The idea of being concerned about microorganisms is different than being phobic. I believe we should be concerned, but not phobic. Hence, your best defense is a strong immune system. So when you have a cold or a flu and your doctor gives you one round of antibiotics, your immune system can be adversely affected for the next year. That is if you come into contact with no more antibiotics. But what about the beef you're eating, the chicken you're eating, the dairy you're consuming? Unless it's organic and from untainted meat, meaning if it's from pasture-raised cattle, for example, then it could be contaminated with antibiotics and probably is, and you build up small amounts and more and more and more concentrations to one day you can have a tipping and the bad bacteria in your gut begin to multiply until now you have distension, gas, bloating, fatigue, and symptoms similar to chronic fatigue. So one more reason that every week, take 2 days a week, let's say Saturday and Sunday for most people, and juice at least 6 times a day. You can make your juice all in one time, freeze it, and then put it in the refrigerator. Even putting it in the refrigerator for 2 days is not going to impact it, especially if you spike it with some vitamin C, which you should, about 5,000 milligrams per, let's say, 32 ounces, and then drink that throughout the day. Here are the primary juices that you should have that detoxify and help reestablish healthy bacteria in your gut and a stronger immune system. You want vitamin C and quercetin. Half the amount of quercetin is vitamin C. I suggest in the range of 1,000 milligrams of quercetin up to 5,000 from vitamin C. It depends upon bowel tolerance, but you'll be testing yourself. If you take too much, you'll get some upset stomach, in which case you'll have to back it down. But let's just say that we start at 1,000 milligrams per drink and then up it to about 2,000 milligrams. My goal is to get people to have about anywhere from 8,000 to 20,000 milligrams of vitamin C taken orally per day, ideally in smoothies, protein shakes. Rarely do I ever suggest you take it on just empty stomach because most people can't handle that. Then add to that a small amount, like an eighth of a teaspoon, of B. propolis. Then add some probiotics. I suggest you simply purchase some probiotics and normally you keep them in the refrigerator and put about 5 billion, that's with a B, billion, probiotics into that drink. The juice of 2 lemons or 2 limes is good. The juice of 1 grapefruit is good. Green apples is terrific. And a beet. Then have that Six times a day. You can also have green tea, in which case you can put the bupropolis, royal jelly, when it's, let's say, tepid, not hot. Royal jelly, bupropolis, manuka honey, pau d'arco, 100 milligrams, astragalus, 100 milligrams, and echinacea, 100 milligrams, plus vitamin C and quercetin, and drink that down. Then you can also have, in a light meal, let's say you have a baked potato. You bake it at lower temperatures, and you cut the potato on all sides, half inch in, and at the ends, and that allows a much quicker cooking time, more even cooking, lower temperatures, and then you oil up the outside of the potato with coconut oil. That way the nutrients like alpha-lipoic acid inside the potato, under the skin, will not be denatured. And then sauté some garlic, lots of it, and the sweetest garlic is your elephant garlic, and very lightly, and then dice up some raw sweet onions, put in some cayenne pepper, and have that. So 2 days a week, if you did things like this, having some fresh avocado with raw onion and some, let's say, some mustard, on a bed of arugula. That is terrific also, with some sun-dried tomatoes and some dried peppers. A little meal, and it's the little meal on Saturday and Sunday, not the big one. And start your day with an all-inclusive, plant-based, protein, phytonutrient, berry-rich shake. So in 2 days of doing that every week, within a month, you've recolonized healthy bacteria. You've built up your immune system. You're going to be stronger day to day. If you're in elevators or public spaces or theaters, you're not going to get sick in all probability because your immune system is stronger. And you can do it in a tasty way as well. A separate study from Wake Forest Medical Center at Wake Forest University says that mindfulness meditation trumps placebo in pain reduction. Quote, scientists at Wake Forest Medical Center have found new evidence that mindfulness meditation reduces pain more effectively than placebo. This is significant because placebo-controlled trials are the recognized standard for demonstrating the efficacy of clinical and pharmaceutical treatments. The research published in the current issue of the Journal of Neuroscience showed that study participants who practiced mindfulness meditation reported greater pain relief than placebo. Significantly, brain scans showed that mindfulness and meditation produce very different patterns of activity than those produced by placebo to relieve pain. Quote, we are completely surprised by the findings, said Dr. Fidel Zaiden, the professor of neurobiology and anatomy at Wake Forest. And he said, while we thought that there would be some overlap in brain regions between meditation and placebo, the findings of this study provide novel and objective evidence that mindfulness meditation reduces pain in a unique fashion. So, what is the takeaway message from this? It means that we have got to slow down. We are doing too many things. We're buying too many things. We're putting our energy into the wrong relationships frequently, the wrong work in the wrong place at the wrong time. We frequently don't even have the right friends. And we have to stop and ask ourselves, what do I need in my life for real happiness, for me to express my inner happiness and joy, my inner love, and be able to share it with people who will not abuse it, take it for granted, or in any way use it against me? Then put a litmus test to the people in your life, to the work in your life, to the places you're in your life, and ask, do all these harmonize you at your highest level? If they do, good. Then you have good friends and you have good family members or whatever it is that you're doing. But more often than not, from my personal experience and professional experience, when I speak with people, they're good people. They don't understand the connection between what they're suffering from and anything else in their life. It's been separate. What's amazing is even when people come who have had a heart attack or stroke, and they will be smokers or drinkers or eat fast foods and be obese and say, you mean that was a cause? And I say, highly probable. What did you think would come? Did you think that smoking a cigarette would make you healthier? I don't know. Well, surely just common sense. Do you think an 80-proof alcohol vodka on your liver, your heart, your kidneys, your stomach, your esophagus lining, do you think that is healthy for you? Or would a glass of orange juice, apple juice, grape juice, tomato juice be healthy? Which of those two do you believe? I don't know. Believe it or not, I don't know is 90% of the answers I get, and sometimes from very educated people. So clearly we have to ask, do they really not know or do they not want to know? Because if you want to know the truth, then you can't start off allowing your subconscious conditioned maladaptive self to gain the upper hand in all of your arguments with ego, anger, pain, crying, whatever emotions you use. You just have to look in the mirror and say, what's looking back at me? Now, most people don't want to see what's looking back. And today we want to Photoshop the image we have of ourselves that other people see, hear. And so there more often than not, there's two people. One that's living in the real world and therefore has to be responsible for the choices they make and the outcome, and another one who is living in an illusionary world, who really believes that the news media is telling them the truth, and the editorialists who are opining about something are objective and fair-minded, and they're really looking out for you because, well, they've said it 1,000 times, it's fair and balanced, or the left is for the people, the proletariat. Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, if that's the kind of illusion you're going to live with, then you're going to have to accept that sooner or later you're going to have multiple choices end up in disasters. Heart disease, cancer, divorce, bankruptcy, alienation, suicide. That's a reward for not being able to see the truth and act on it proactively. I call it intentional neglect. What we intentionally choose not to know, we will not keep an open mind to. Be around very orthodox people, and whatever their orthodoxy is. They can be orthodox as a scientist, as a physician, as a banker, and then ask them a question that challenges their orthodoxy, and instead of looking for the truth, they look to defend their orthodox position. Mindfulness, on the other hand, allows you to sit quietly, alone, no music, no radio, no cell phones, and just be. Just be happy in the moment you're in and mindful of your breathing, mindful of the environment you're in, mindful of what you're hearing. That's why if you can ever get to, mind you, we're heard all over the world. So please understand I'm speaking with people now in over 180 countries and over 67,000, I believe, in India alone. So find the place in your environment where you can be close to nature, where you can smell wonderful aromas, where you can hear sounds of nature, and just be. Don't think about anything. That's mindfulness. And that relaxes you. That turns off stress hormones. That helps you deal with pain and anxiety and depression and stress. And finally, a good study of men who eat soy have lower risk of lung cancer. And this is the University of Texas. A good study. They studied 36,000 men and 40,000 women. And what they found over 11 years is that those men who ate the most soy had the least amount of lung cancer. And this was reported in BBC Health. So I examined personally over 5,000 studies from the peer-reviewed literature on the benefits of soy. I then excluded every single study that was sponsored by the soy industry, and therefore I had independent studies. And what I found was from lung cancer and prostate cancer and breast cancer to heart disease and dementia and Alzheimer's, soy made a big difference in your overall health. Now, I'm talking about organic, non-GMO soy. I'm not talking about it being the primary ingredient in your diet. I'm talking about no more than 160 grams a day. Now, the amount that they suggest is 162 grams a day. So that's, you know, you're talking about 28 grams to an ounce. You're not talking about a whole lot. You're talking about what would amount to about a half a cup of soy a day in your whole diet. So it's a small but important part. So let's do something good for our health. Let's see that we're eating some form of soy in our diet on a regular basis. And you could reduce your risk, not just of lung cancer, because the concept is, it is called intellectual coupling. You take a principle that a vitamin C in a good study was shown to prevent breast cancer or prostate cancer, or ovarian cancer, or lung cancer, then it should also make an impact on all cancers. Now, many scientists or physicians say, well, there wasn't a study on that particular cancer. Well, that's disingenuous, because that's assuming that there is no Gaia concept. There is no larger environment to which we are in. That means you're talking then with a monotheistic person, and that's going to be a very short end conversation, meaning if they don't have absolute proof of something on and that's micromanaged proof, they won't believe it. Where those who are more reasonable, more progressive, say, well, if I drink a glass of vegetable juice and it's shown to lower my blood pressure, there's no reason I should not support using it for overall health. There's got to be other things it's doing. The fact that reality exists before science is able to prove its existence does not mean there was no reality prior to it. And one of the best examples that I use is when they come up with a new study that shows that after 20 years or 30 years of not doing something, if we had done it, oh gee whiz, we'd had a reduction. And then my argument is, so are you suggesting that no one benefited anywhere in the world at any time with billions of people using that until you proved its use? Now that you've proven it, now you say all reality starts from this moment going forward. I would say every human being who engaged in healthy choices was benefiting all along, and yet all 100% of orthodox science and medicine, with few exceptions, would say, no, 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 it all has to be evidence-based. And any doctor, any scientist who says it all has to be evidence-based, say, fine, if that's the way you want to play it, but I'm going to walk in your mosque, I'm going to walk in your synagogue, I'm going to walk in your chapel, your church, your cathedral, and I'm going to ask you, why are you here? Well, I'm here because I'm a Catholic, a Jew, a Muslim. You know, where's the proof? Oh, you mean you want that proof to be absolute when it comes to those of us who believe that meditation or yoga or our thoughts or our beliefs or prayer has an important role in healing? But that's kept separate. And if we don't have absolute scientific proof, you discard all of it, won't use it. But you then come here. That's the hypocrisy of your average physician, scientist, and not most people, because most people actually are more open-minded than that. One last one, University of Washington, from the British Medical Journal, Nephrology. When you increase the amount of coenzyme Q10, you're going to get a decrease in oxidative stress. And oxidative stress is one of the primary causes of many diseases, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, dementia, Alzheimer's. So here's what it says, quote, findings of this trial reported in the BMC reveal an association between periodically elevating doses of coenzyme Q10 and decreasing levels of plasma isoflurane, a marker of arachidonic acid peroxidation in patients undergoing dialysis. So subjects were given 300 milligrams for 14 days, followed by 14 days of 600 milligrams, then 1,200 milligrams and 1,800 milligram doses were administered. And then they did the blood samples, and they found that, quote, plasma Q10 levels increased linearly in association with supplemental doses. So it meant that to help these people, it made a big difference. Big difference. So that's good. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. don't know. Now, I want to share some insights with you because I think this is important. First, I want to share something from Common Dreams. This is a piece that we posted today. It says, How Government Crackdown on Whistleblowers Betrays Public Interest. The United States government is not doing enough to protect national security whistleblowers, leaving those who expose corruption vulnerable to prosecution, undermining valuable information exchange for journalists and the public, and allowing government abuse to run rampant. A new report by the Free Speech Advocacy Group published Tuesday has found in its report called Secret Sources, Whistleblowers, National Security, and Free Expression, at least 57 federal laws with whistleblower or witness protection provisions are not consistent in terms of who they apply to and protect. Moreover, public debate over high-profile leaks, such as the National Security Agency and NSA, files released in 2013 by former contractor Edward Snowden, is stymied by policymakers and public officials who claim whistleblower protections are stronger than they really are, as Hillary Clinton did during the Democratic presidential debate in October, when she stated of Snowden that he could, quote, he could have been a whistleblower, he could have gotten all the protections of being a whistleblower, he could have raised all the issues that he raised, and I think there would have been a positive response to it, end quote. But the report in the government's own track record proves Clinton is wrong. Quote, as a government contractor, Snowden had few, if any, protections under whistleblower protection compared to intelligence employees who are hired directly by the U.S. government, the report states. And under President Barack Obama's administration, intelligence workers who leak information to the public are likely to be tried under the Espionage Act of 1917, the same law that was used to prosecute whistleblowers including Chelsea Manning, Jeffrey Sterling, Thomas Drake, John Kirikawa, Stephen Jim Ho Kim, Shami Leibowitz, James Hitzelberger, and Donald Sachdlin. Snowden also faces charges under the Espionage Act if he returns home. Quote, the law, the espionage law, is broad, vague, and not easy to defend against. Now, let's hear now from a CIA 9/11 whistleblower, Susan Lindauer, interviewed about what you did not know could have been an otherwise outcome. She could have prevented the entire Iraq fiasco, all that death, all the millions exposed to depleted uranium, over a million dead civilians, the total destruction of their infrastructure, the chaos and sectarian violence that have occurred since then, all that could have been prevented had she been allowed as a whistleblower to tell what she knew. Listen in, please.
Since 9/11, this country's desire for safety and security has given the U.S. government an unprecedented and unchecked amount of power. We've seen a crackdown on dissent that's unparalleled in recent history, including an outright assault on whistleblowers. Obama alone has already charged 8 people with espionage under a law drafted during World War I that was designated for foreign spies. The latest to be charged, of course, is Edward Snowden, an American citizen who's revealed the extent of the NSA's spying apparatus. And although Snowden's story continues to make international headlines, other lesser-known whistleblowers over the years have also exposed disturbing aspects of the security state, one of which is Susan Lindauer, ex-CIA asset and author of the book Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 and Iraq. She's joining us now to talk about her experience whistleblowing about Iraq and 9/11 and also just the greater war on whistleblowers. Here she is. Susan, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
So you claim that you were indicted, not charged, but indicted under the Patriot Act. Can you break down the most simplest of terms to the audience? What happened to you?
My story is a cautionary tale in this age of Edward Snowden and Julian Assange. Both of those men are very right to be afraid of the U.S. courts, and there are special considerations that Russia and Ecuador need to take into account when considering whether to grant asylum requests or whether to return them to the United States. And my case illustrates that. I was the chief CIA asset covering Iraq and Libya at the United Nations from 1995 to 2003. I gave advance warning about 9/11, and there was a peace option on the table with Iraq that the United States wanted to suppress. 30 days after I requested to testify on Capitol Hill, I went to Congress and requested to testify through proper channels. I woke to hear the FBI pounding on my door with an arrest warrant on the Patriot Act.
And you were accused of accepting unsolicited bribes from Iraqi, basically a spy for Iraqi intelligence, and that's incorrect.
That was incorrect, but that was incorrect information. There was no evidence to support it. So after the United States made the accusations, they invoked the Patriot Act to deprive me of the right to a trial. They refused even to grant my request for a hearing. I was hit with secret charges, secret evidence, secret grand jury testimony. I was never allowed to know who had accused me of what crime. The government had no obligation to provide any evidence that the crime ever occurred. But I was then in the court of public opinion, I was already convicted.
Of course, just like all these other whistleblowers that we're seeing today. So let's talk about the warnings that you tried to give about 9/11. You said in April of 2001, you were actually told by someone higher up in the administration that about an imminent attack. I mean, specific details here: World Trade Center, hijacking of airplanes. What were you working on that you needed to know that information? I mean, you say that you were a CIA asset.
I was a covert back channel to the Iraqi embassy. And my CIA handler, Dr. Richard Fuse, instructed me to pass a message in April of 2001 to Iraqi diplomats and the Iraqi ambassador that the United States was seeking any fragment of intelligence regarding airplane hijackings and a known strike on the World Trade Center, and the threat that the United States was threatening war with Iraq from the highest levels of government, quote, and when you're back channel, it's very precise, quote, above the Secretary of State and above the CIA director. Now, that's only three people: the President of the United States, the Vice President, and the Secretary of Defense. That meant that all three of those individuals already knew about 9/11 in April of 2001.
And we know now that there were, I mean, dozens of warnings. It went well beyond the August 6th PDB that everyone talks about. I mean, we're talking about the light blinking red for months and months.
Yes.
Susan, my question, I guess, if people knew specifics, I mean, we're talking about specifics, not just warning, Bin Laden, you know, attack impending. Mm-hmm. Why didn't more people call out the government's total plea of incompetence after the fact?
Well, what the government did was the government made an example of those of us who knew the truth. And they said, if you cross the line. Now, I want to emphasize, I requested to testify through proper channels. I was a whistleblower, but I did it through Congress. I tried to do it through Congress. And a lot of whistleblowers are citing my case as evidence that the going through the proper channels is not going to work and is not going to protect the public or the whistleblower. It makes no difference. If the government feels threatened, they will attack you, even if you're doing everything right. So why not make sure that the public has the information?
So you're saying,
if you'd known about the Iraqi peace option, the whole world could have stopped the Iraq war.
Well, of course. So, you were trying to broker peace between Iraq as this liaison for the government. And so are you saying that the government purposefully allowed 9/11 to happen, made 9/11 happen?
Yes.
And that they were not
Absolutely.
Interested in avoiding war with Iraq at
They
all?
Had already decided that if the 9/11 conspiracy maximized damage on the towers, that there would be a perfect pretext for war. And they were overriding Iraq's response to that was to invite the FBI to send a task force on terrorism into Baghdad with authorization to conduct a pre-9/11 investigation. Iraq said, if you think that there's evidence here, come get it. We want to help you because we want to preserve the peace option.
Well, what's weird is, why didn't they tell you to go try to broker between Saudi Arabia or Afghanistan? I mean, they knew that Bin Laden was involved in the PDB and the briefings. Why Iraq? It seems so non sequitur.
Yeah, oh, exactly. There was no, and Saddam Hussein was one of our best sources on terrorism intelligence. Yeah. Throughout the 90s, Iraq was very afraid of the Islamic jihadis who might stabilize the secular regime and take advantage of the poverty caused by sanctions to try to bring about some Islamic revolution. So Saddam was very eager to help identify terrorist conspiracies, and he saw that as a strong point of his administration, that he could reach across the table and keep a line open to Washington. And that's what I existed to do, because even under sanctions, we still had to protect international security from terrorist threat.
In light of the recent NSA revelation, Susan, I mean, you yourself were subject to really harsh crackdown from the government. I mean, even the author of the Patriot Act, though, he said that he never intended it to be used in the way that it is now. I mean, what do you think? When you're looking at everything that's happened over the last decade, did you foresee it ever getting to where it's gone and how pervasive it's become?
I was the second non-Arab American ever indicted on the Patriot Act. And the Patriot Act has criminalized dissension. It says that sedition is the act of opposing the government through nonviolent means has become such a threat that free speech itself is now criminalized by the Patriot Act. And I think we're going to see the Patriot Act applied to many more people, many more situations that were never
now,
intended.
Keep in mind, after keeping her in solitary confinement, not allowing her to have a lawyer, not allowing her to know any information about her, she asks, what evidence do you have? If you have evidence I've done something wrong, show it. Bring it forth. They didn't. The government, acting the way they typically do, had no counterbalance to this, and they just wanted to keep her quiet until after the full extent of what she could say would have been known, and hence now we were into the Iraq War. So after a year, they let her out one day. That was it. No apology, nothing, just let her out. Oh, you're free to go. So you just took a year of my life? You accused me of being involved in espionage? You have no evidence to it? I did nothing? I could have stopped the Iraqi war? I could have stopped the invasion? And now you just let me go? Yeah, you're free to go. That's the government that we have had for a long time. How do we get there? I want to quote from Global Research. It's a short piece. It'll give you some insights. Is called Neocon 101, What Do Neoconservatives Believe? Because all the major positions, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, all the Republicans, Bernie Sanders, these are all neocons. Bush, Obama, neocons. Everyone in the State Department in a policymaking position, Defense Department, neocons. The neocons believe that the United States should not be ashamed to use its unrivaled power forcefully, if necessary, to promote American values around the world. And many people speak of the need to cultivate a U.S. empire, and the neoconservatives believe modern threats facing U.S. can no longer be reliably contained and therefore must be prevented, hence the preemptive military action. So no matter how big the military is, it's never big enough for these people who deal in this kind of Orwellian dystopian mindset. Now, most neocons believe that the U.S. has allowed dangers to gather by not spending enough on defense and not confronting threats aggressively, even if no threats actually exist. And one such threat, they contend, was Saddam Hussein and his pursuit of weapons of mass destruction. And since 1991, Gulf War neocons relentlessly advocated for Saddam ouster. Now, most neocons share unwavering support for Israel, which they see as crucial to U.S. military sufficiency in a volatile region. They also see Israel as a key outpost of democracy in a region ruled by despotics, believing that authoritarianism and theocracy have allowed anti-Americanism to flourish in the Middle East, and neocons advocate the democratic transformation of the region, starting with Iraq. And democratic transformation is we go in, we either buy off the politicians and take control of the government, privatize its assets, or we do it militarily. That's the democratic transformation of the region based upon being a neocon. They also believe that the U.S. is unnecessarily hampered by multilateral institutions. Therefore, they want no rules, no laws to limit their being able to neutralize the enemy. The original neocons were a small group of mostly liberal intellectuals who in the 1960s and 70s grew disenchanted with what they saw as the American left's social excesses and reluctance to spend adequately on defense. Now, many of these neocons worked in the 1970s for the Democratic Senator Henry Scoop Jackson. By the way, he was a rabid anti-communist. He was right up there with Joe McCarthy. By the 1980s, most neocons had become Republicans, finding in President Ronald Reagan an anti-communist and an avenue for their aggressive approach of confronting the Soviet Union with bold rhetoric and steep hikes in military spending. After the Soviet Union's fall, the neocons decried what they saw as America's complacency. In the 1990s, they warned of the dangers of reducing both America's defense spending and its role in the world. And unlike their predecessors, most younger neocons never experienced being left of center. They always had been Reagan Republicans. So what is the difference between a neoconservative and a conservative? Well, liberals first applied the neo prefix to their comrades who broke ranks to become more conservative in the 1960s and 70s. The defectors remain more liberal on some domestic policy issues. But foreign policy stands have always defined neoconservatism. Where other conservatives favored détente and containment of the Soviet Union, neocons pushed for direct military confrontation. Mind you, you're talking about a major nuclear war. They didn't care. Today, both conservatives and neocons favor a robust U.S. military. If you doubt me, listen to the humorist in the afternoon, Mark Levin, when he does his comedy show. And all he can talk about is the Constitution and spending money on the military. I don't think there's any other two solutions. Well, spending more money on the military doesn't get you anything except more spending on the military. We don't become safer. It would be as if I were to put a glass of water into every thirsty person's hand in the United States and began to fill it. And you kept saying, I'm really thirsty, Gary, I'm really thirsty. And so I pour 12 gallons of water into an 8-ounce glass, and it's flowing over. The whole floor is flooded. And you keep saying, I'm really thirsty, Gary. And I'm saying, "Why? How much water do you need to satisfy your thirst? I don't know, but it's never going to be enough. So you got to give me 10,000 gallons a day, but you don't need it. So no one, and I repeat, no one in the neoconservative, conservative community and the liberal Democrats ask a basic question. How much money do we need to spend in order to be safe? Well, I've done the research, and it's no more than $200 billion. But their official budget is $600 billion now, and their off-the-books and other extended budgets are another $600 to $700 billion. So it's about $1.3 to $1.4 trillion per year. There's 200,000 companies and businesses who profit from this. They don't make us safer. They just keep getting their contracts renewed, ever expanded, and they get cost-plus benefits. That means that whatever cost they tell the government it's going to take this year, their jets, their expenses paid, meals, everything is included. Their bonuses for their senior executives, all included. We the people pay it. Are they actually making us safe? The answer is no, they're not. But don't tell that to a corporate liberal, corporate Democrat, neoconservative, or typical corporate conservative, because they are already way too far into this electromagnetic pulsation of their ideology in their brain. They're not coming back. So that's where we have ended up getting these people who believe that Edward Snowden should go to jail, that anyone who says anything negative about the government, that they should be prosecuted. Now, on the phone right now, by the way, for those of you who are listening, and a lot of people, I just got the latest numbers, a lot of people are listening over some listening device other than a land-based station. I want to thank you. The numbers are staggering. We're approaching 20 million minutes. 20 million? That's 20 million minutes. So you can listen at any time at noon Eastern time by calling 712-775-775. 6850, 712-775-6850. If for any reason you turn on your local station, I'm not there, call the number, write it down, because it's going to happen. 712-775-6850. Let's go over now to our conference phone. Sitting by is Richard Gale. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good.
Oh, we just start on different things. Given time, where would you like to begin? I wanted to focus on this on the campaign, the candidates.
Yes.
You know, listening to you and just what you were saying, and I had an image kind of shot in my mind that in many ways, when we're looking at Hillary's record or trying to get a sense on what she really believes or what kind of proposals would she really be putting forth, there's so much unclarity. Hillary speaks in such broad generalizations to come down to nail her down on what specific kind of policies and revisions she would actually do is very unclear.
Let me take a crack at it then, because
I was thinking, am I perhaps dealing? Are we perhaps dealing like with the Ayn Rand of the left?
Good analysis. She is the Ayn Rand of the left.
It would be a wonderful comparison, you know, kind of investigative comparison to look at the two. I think there would be some surprising revelations to come from that.
Well, let me share some insights on Hillary Clinton, because right now she is the leading Democratic contender. And unfortunately, Jill Stein was not invited to any of the debates, or that would have been a game changer for most Americans. First, Hillary Clinton believes that we should reform the bankruptcy laws, but she doesn't tell us how. And one thing she will not do, she will not go towards what progressives would, which is to bring back the Glass-Steagall Act, to criminalize any behavior of any corporate employee who intentionally and with malice aforethought made any deal to make money where the American public were victims, so that no longer could you pay billions of dollars and walk away is what happens now. She defends to the hilt the people's right to make a mistake. She just will say, well, okay, we'll fine them if they make a mistake. Well, when fining a pharmaceutical company is of no deterrent, because nor is it Wall Street, because they simply add that into the cost of doing business. So, for example, if there was one bank that made $800 billion, with a B, billion dollars, in transactions by money laundering, including drug money and even terrorist money, they were fined $900 million. But they were not forced to give back any ill-gotten gains. So why doesn't Hillary say, I will make every penny that anyone who commits any crime pay back? We will confiscate their assets. We will take away the charter of that corporation so they can no longer do business, take them through structured bankruptcy, and pass the laws to do that, and take this to the Supreme Court. Because until you make it too painful for anyone to break the law, they're going to continue to break it, and then bring back Glass-Steagall. Also, she supports limiting credit card interest. That's good. To 30%.
Yes.
30%. Exactly. And that's 30% not including compounding interest if a person fails to pay it. Then she has been a long-time advocate of the death penalty, which I believe is just foolish, and she's a hard line towards Russia. Russia's not the enemy. China's not the enemy. Russia and China are prospering. They have an enormous upper-educated middle class. In fact, both countries now have more people in their upper mobile middle class than we do. And China has more upper middle class people than we have entire population of America. So do you think that all these gains, all their quality of life, all their universities, their homes, their infrastructures, do you think they want to risk that? They're not going to allow that to be risks. So everything is just trying to create a new Cold War. They're not the enemy. We should be cooperating with them instead of trying to destroy them. She is also a fanatical, rabid supporter of Israel, the Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Ukraine. Now, it's interesting because under her tenure, we gave Egypt, during the uprising, we gave them military aid and continued to fund them. And we continued to support the dictatorship, because it was really a military dictatorship with Mubarak. But also she supported the Ukrainian fraud. And she supported the Saudi Arabians, who are the biggest terrorists in the world. They support more terrorism. They fund more terrorism. They train more terrorism. And right now, if you want to talk about a mess, Syria's a mess, but look at a bigger mess with more starving people, more people who have been displaced, more people who are food insecure. Look at Yemen. And look at the consequence. That's directly the consequence of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. So then look at the opposition around the world now to apartheid in Israel, including by many, many Israelis who are not Zionists, who believe that there is a peaceful coexistence possible, but not with Hillary Clinton. She also supports mandatory vaccines. Did she not say, quote, the science is clear, vaccines work? Well, they don't. She also is the biggest supporter of Obamacare because she tried to give her own form of Obamacare, and we beat it. Mm-hmm. Now, she was a big supporter of GMOs. She worked with Walmart. She worked with Monsanto. And also, she wants to increase NATO, total criminal organization, and a warmongering organization. And she also wants to have some say-so on carbon credit issues. We shouldn't have carbon credit as an issue at all. We should simply reduce greenhouse emissions completely. So that's part of it. Then also take a look at Sarah Westwood's article on many Clinton charity donors also got State Department awards under Hillary Clinton. In fact, 22 of the 37 corporations nominated for a prestigious State Department award and 6 of the 8 ultimate winners, while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State and hence had to get her personal approval, were also donors to the Clinton Family Foundation. And that's based upon published records. Then take a look at who owns Hillary. And a lot of people don't know this, but Ben Horton did a good job on informing us about what is called it's a nonviolent boycott, divestment, and sanctions, the BDS. It's a movement to try to let people know that don't buy products if those products were manufactured in occupied areas. And Hillary went to one of the wealthiest American billionaires, an Israeli named Haim Saban, S-A-B-A-N, and implored him, you know, to consider her support of Israel. And she is completely pro everything Israel does and has no ability to understand what it is to be a Palestinian. And she also doesn't want any of the networking going on to boycott Israel. So, and she's very clear on that. Also, Jonathan Benson did a nice piece called The Clinton Foundation, a cesspool of corporate poisoners, junk food companies, and pushers of vaccines and GMOs. And that's what they do. Bill Gates, the largest contributor, I think $26+ million to the Clinton Foundation. It's brought in over $2 billion. And these are the kind of neocons, these are all neocons, getting together and deciding how to make the world into their private domain. Next person.
No, that's true. Oh, that's very true, Gary. It truly is. And, right now, it appears that Rubio is the front runner. And I think this will probably waffle back and forth, and who knows, there could be other surprise dark horses popping into this race, since it seems to be just a traveling freak circus going on in the GOP. But Rubio's main,
let's look at Rubio.
Yeah.
Good-looking guy.
We know where he stands on the kind of literalist fundamental Christian values that taint a lot of his thinking concerning, abortion, the subservience of women. Therefore, he does oppose equal pay for women. He actually opposed in office the Violence Against Women Act, which would have protected, given women a little more rights in the, particularly in the workplace. So he stands by a lot of these patriarchal Christian values.
Okay, but here's what bothers me. He supports Saudi Arabia, as does Bernie Sanders, by the way. Why don't we just take a moment, Richard, and look at Saudi Arabia? Now, mind you, Obama supports Saudi Arabia, the State Department, John Kerry. Here's what you should know about Saudi Arabia. First, selling or wearing anything red on Valentine's Day, including selling roses and anything shaped as hearts, is banned. Men and women cannot mix together at malls or restaurants or in public spaces. Banned. Movie theaters in public. Banned. Music classes in public schools. Banned. Gyms and sports for women. Banned. A woman traveling unless she receives a special authorization form or accompanies her husband or father. Banned. Women driving. Banned. In fact, public gatherings for any political or human rights or civil reason is banned. and then in the top three countries in the world with the worst human rights violations, meaning the most beheadings, amputations, lashings for what is considered misdemeanors in any other civilized country, Saudi Arabia. So we talk about beheadings by ISIS. Why don't we talk about amputations and lashings and beheadings by Saudi Arabia? We talk about ISIS, but not Saudi Arabia. Also, the international human rights groups and even the UN investigations are banned categorically. So they don't allow anyone to come into their country to examine any of their rights abuses. And yet they end up getting appointed through John Kerry, through Obama, and through Hillary Clinton to the support behind channels to be at the top of the human rights program at the UN. What hypocrisy is that? And in business and economics, they lie constantly about the amount of education programs they have, their employment rate, their university degrees, especially in engineering and MBAs, their salaries. You can't believe a damn thing coming out of Saudi Arabia. And yet Rubio, who also he was against the poor getting subsidies, but he wanted $60 million subsidy for the Marlins baseball stadium. He supports collecting your DNA. He supports federal laws to override state marijuana laws. He opposes recreational pot. He wants banks that he believes that the banks, he stated, the banks didn't want to be bailed out. Lie. They did. He also opposed the Violence Against Women Act. He also supports he supports further privatization of our transportation system. And he voted against the major protections of our oceans, coasts, and Great Lakes ecosystems. He is a great military ideologue against Iran, and he's a fanatical supporter of Israel. He wants to reduce all trade barriers, hence he's for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He's a mandatory vaccine person, and he believes that our Defense Department should spend more. He bans gays from the military, wants to. He opposes all UN arms trade treaties because we're the major supplier of arms around the world. He imposed the increase in minimum wage. He increased retirement age. He opposed net neutrality. And he opposes the timetable to withdraw from Afghanistan. And he opposed the government's war on poverty. So, mind you, go beyond what he looks like. Go beyond how he sounds. Go to what he actually values and believes in. And he and the rest of them, including Ben Cardin. And the trouble is people think because Ben has a medical degree, I can show you a lot of medical doctors who've killed their patients using therapies that were outdated or known to be toxic. The fact you have an MD doesn't mean that you are a more enlightened person at all. I can show you a lot of very stupid medical doctors, PhDs, professors, and people in power. The fact that he believes and actually said, what did he say, quote, I believe in the six-day creation, literally 6 days and not metaphorical days. Well, exactly how do you reconcile that with the most known carbon dating, even if it's off by 10,000 years, pushes us back still into the millions of years? He has no proof of the flood in the Bible causing the ice age. Yeah, he doesn't believe in that we can evolve. He believes in a warped view of the second law of thermodynamics, the movement towards disorder and entropy. So on every level, these people, and they're all pretty much the same, I think that they have a very limited view of life. And because they have a limited view of life and are anti-science and anti-environment and anti-poor and anti-helping people, except for corporations, except the military-industrial complex, except the banking complex, except when making war. They support the taking away of the Constitution, and yet they call themselves conservatives. I believe that the whole Republican and conservative movement has to have an awakening that if you truly believe in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, then you would repeal the Patriot Act, you would repeal the National Defense Authorization Act, you would repeal the fact that we don't have habeas corpus. You would be completely different in approaching freedom of speech, which we've now outlawed for all intents and purposes. You can still say something, but watch how quickly you're put on an enemies list for what you say. Final thoughts, Richard?
Well, I think the Republicans are very keen on returning over and over again to the Constitution. One of the things to recognize is that you also hear how they believe that the Constitution is somehow intrinsically flawed, and therefore it's their responsibility to correct it. And that just simply means to invest their own interests and to rewrite their own interests into these kind of amendments they always constantly want to do with the Constitution. And even outside of the judicial system, that's their specific role, is to be able to review constitutional laws and make determinations whether something is falls within the Constitution or not. And if they had their way, they would just bypass that system altogether.
Okay. Richard Gill, thanks for coming on and
giving Gary.
A different perspective. I'm Gary Nell. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Have a good day.